This is the Quality News Network. United Nations Security Council has resumed debate on whether a draft resolution condemning North Korea's recent missile launches should also call for sanctions. China and Russia are opposed, saying they prefer diplomacy. Meanwhile, Pyongyang says it plans to test launch even more missiles, something it claims it has a legal right to do because it is not bound by any international law or bilateral or multilateral agreements. The Space Shuttle Discovery successfully docked with the International Space Station just over 2 hours ago, a coupling that will continue for the next 11 days while the astronauts conduct a variety of scientific tests and experiments. In Mexico, conservative Felipe Calderón appears to be heading for victory in the closest presidential election in that country's history. His opponent, Andrés Miguel López Obrador, says should he lose, he will challenge the results in federal court. Atlantic City casinos remain closed for a second day, and Governor John Corzine says they'll remain closed until the legislature hammers out a budget. New York State's highest court is refusing to recognize same-sex marriages, declaring that the issue should be addressed by the legislature. And just hours after the New York ruling, Georgia's state Supreme Court reinstated Georgia's constitutional ban on gay marriage. More violence in Iraq. A dozen Iranian pilgrims killed near a Shiite Muslim shrine in Kufa when their buses were attacked by a suicide car bomber. 40 were injured. Iraq's prime minister is calling upon the U.S. military to keep reckless troops from serving in Iraq. One ex-GI has been charged with the rape and murder of an Iraqi teen and the killing of her family in Mahmoudiya in March, and other arrests are expected. An American Army lieutenant, who refused deployment to Iraq last month because of his concerns over the legality of the war, has now been charged by the Army with three counts, including conduct unbecoming an officer. If found guilty on all the charges, Lieutenant Aaron Matata could face several years in prison as well as a dishonorable discharge. Iran has agreed to preliminary discussions later today with the European Union negotiators in Belgium, but is postponing until next week any formal talks about its nuclear program, and even then says it will not be prepared to give its answer to the incentives proposal offered by the EU. Violence escalating in Gaza, where Israeli forces have stepped up their offensive against Palestinian militants, 12 of whom were killed in fighting today. Researchers at Scripps Institute of Oceanography say the increase in the number of wildfires in the western U.S. in the last couple of years may be tied to global warming. And close to 100 new words are being added to Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, among them the verb to Google. Business news is coming up.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
Calling it excessive, the Florida Supreme Court has thrown out a $145 billion punitive damage award against cigarette makers, the largest award ever by an American jury. Freddie Mac reports that the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage average rose last week by 0.01%, from 6.79% to 6.78%. The Mortgage Bankers Association says that mortgage applications were up 5.9% during the week ending in June 30th. That's the first increase in 3 weeks. Planned layoffs by American employers rose last month for the first time this year by 25%. New claims for unemployment totaled 313,000 last week. That's down 2,000 from the previous week. Southwest Airlines says it's raising its one-way fares by $3 to $10 due to higher fuel costs. The increases will only affect flights longer than 750 miles. Three people have been charged in federal court with stealing confidential information from Coca-Cola, including a sample of a new drink, and then trying to sell it to Pepsi. Once they approached Pepsi, Pepsi called Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola called the FBI, which conducted an undercover investigation. Microsoft will reportedly start selling a wireless digital music and video player this Christmas to compete with Apple's iPod. The new player will let users download music and videos over the air. Light sweet crude oil is trading this hour at $75.10 a barrel. That's down at 9 cents a barrel. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 75 points, NASDAQ is up 4 points, and the S&P 500 is also up 4 points. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. There's a crisis in the Middle East today. There's a crisis in the Middle East last week. There always seems to be a crisis in the Middle East. And today it's more likely to be Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan. But most of us remember a time when crisis in the Middle East always meant a conflict between Israel and the Arabs, between Israel and the Palestinians. And it's an age-old conflict, one that most of us wish would finally resolve its way into peace, but never seems to find a way to do that. Israel, having withdrawn from Gaza, which is an area where Palestinians live, an area that actually used to be controlled by Egypt before 1967, has withdrawn entirely, removed their settlements, and yet the elected government of the Palestinians, which is Hamas, refuses to accept the existence of Israel, continues its implacable, never-ending war, and sends missiles over into Israeli cities and towns near the border. Most recently, of course, Hamas tunneled under the Israeli fence protecting the border and killed two soldiers and kidnapped a third, 19-year-old Corporal Gilad Shalit, and brought him back to Gaza. And Israel has had a very strong response. Israel wants its soldier back and has made it clear that it will stop at virtually nothing to get its soldier back, including bombing the head Hamas and taking out electricity plants and bridges and so forth. It's a very strong stand. Some argue that Israel has taken too strong a stand. Others argue that this is the only way to respond to terrorism. My guest today takes a very interesting stand. It's really a very unusual and fascinating person. Her name is Nani Darwish. She's the author of the book that's coming out this fall called Now They Call Me Infidel, Why I Rejected Jihad for America, Israel, and the War on Terror. She's a woman who grew up in Gaza. She grew up in Gaza when it was under the Egyptian administration before 1960. People forget that the West Bank and Gaza before 1967 were controlled by Egypt and Jordan, who didn't give the Palestinians a state either, and then lived under Israeli occupation of Gaza for another dozen years or so until she came to the United States of America and found, I think, her true home, as she would say. But her perspective is very interesting because she doesn't defend the acts of I don't want to call her people because she's not Palestinian, she's an Arab, but she certainly doesn't defend the acts of the Muslims who are in Gaza attacking Israel right now. And I think I really should let her speak for herself. So, Ms. Darwish, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Oh, hi, Mark. It's a pleasure.
It's really a pleasure to have you here. Before we get into today, and I definitely want to get into what's going on today with Corporal Shalit and so forth, I want to take the time, and one of the nice things about radio is we have the entire hour. It's not like TV where you have to get your points out in 5 minutes. We have an entire hour to really discuss the situation, and you have such an interesting past. I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit of your past, where you grew up, what happened to your father. I was reading a lot of it on your website. Why don't you tell our listeners where you come from?
I was born in Cairo in 1948, and then Egypt ruled over Gaza in the 50s and the 60s up to the 67 war. My father headed the Egyptian military intelligence in Gaza, and he started the Fida'iyin under the orders of Nasser, President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt. And the Fida'iyin, they did not commit the kind of terror we're seeing today, they didn't do suicide bombing. But they did infiltrate into Israel and cause a lot of death to civilians. And
so your father worked for the Egyptian government in Gaza, basically infiltrating into Israel and trying to kill civilians.
Yes, and cause as much damage, destruction, and death inside Israel. It was the purpose of the Egyptian government. It's actually, Gamal Abdel Nasser, he wanted to unify the Arab world and destroy Israel. That was a major part of his commitment. And my father was a soldier. He was a colonel in the military. And he died as a result of this by Israel.
Israel retaliated against your father.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, one night, a few months before he was killed, the Israeli commanders actually came into our home, and they were looking for my father. But on that night, my father was not home. And all they found were us children and my mother. And as a matter of fact, our home was heavily guarded, and they were able to come in. And luckily,
you must have been very scared. How old were you at the time?
I was 8.
So you must have been terribly frightened.
I slept through the incident.
Oh, you slept through it? They didn't wake you up?
They didn't even wake us up, children. But in the morning, we found a lot of commotion. The whole security personnel surrounding our house was taken for interrogation by the Egyptian government. And as a matter of fact, my favorite soldier, who used to play with us in the yard, he was actually killed during interrogation.
Now, what's fascinating, by the Egyptians?
Yes.
He was killed by the Egyptians for allowing the Israelis to get into your home, I guess.
He was being interrogated because they wanted to know how they came in. So I lived my childhood in a war zone.
Well, what's fascinating to me is that most people, I venture to say, if their father, as yours was killed by the Israelis, and you seem to understand that he had, you know, done his own killing and there was retaliation. But I think most people in your situation would be so angry at the country that killed your father that they would declare eternal jihad, eternal war. Did you originally have this hatred of Israel?
I was very angry. I was indoctrinated with hatred and with that and with lies. And as a matter of fact, I was like that for many, many, many years. But when I started learning the other side of the story, that there was damage, destruction, and death, that Israel had to defend itself. And, of course, the lies that we heard as children, they portrayed the Israelis as people who were aliens who came and invaded the land, not as people who lived there, most of them. As a matter of fact, most people who live in Israel are Middle Eastern Jews.
Right. Mostly kicked out of Arab countries, in fact.
Exactly. And many of them were from Egypt itself, about 80,000 of them. And so I learned the truth by myself, really, and after I came to this wonderful country, the United States. And I realized that the Arab world, 22 Arab countries under the leadership of the Arab League, have created a monster in the West Bank and Gaza. They have pampered them, they have brutalized them, they have done everything to push them against the borders of Israel and make their lives as miserable as possible in order for them to always fight and never accept peace with Israel.
I want to give a little bit of history to our listeners. You and I know this history well, Ms. Darwish, but some of our listeners may not. When Israel became a state in 1947, 1948, the land that was the British Mandate of Palestine was divided to be a Jewish state and an Arab state. Israel, the Jews at that time, accepted their half of the land, accepted the state of Israel. The Arabs did not. And what's interesting is that Egypt invaded, Jordan invaded, Syria, all the Arab states invaded. And the land that was supposed to become the Palestinian state, namely what is today Gaza and the West Bank and even a little more land, was conquered by Egypt and Jordan. And they didn't make it into a Palestinian state. There could have been one between 48 and 67. And I think a lot of people today, I don't know, don't realize that. Today, after 1967 in Gaza, when Israel occupied the land, did there need to be let me ask you this. Was there some resentment against Egypt before 1967 for their occupation of Gaza?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the first intifada that happened in Gaza ever was
against the Egyptians.
The rule of the oppressive rule of Nasser in Egypt. And not a lot of people know that. And as a matter of fact, the same resentment also happened against Jordan by the Palestinian. So when there was a lot of trouble coming from this area to the Arab world, and vice versa, a lot of trouble imposed on that area by the Arab world. And it's because the truth is they had so many laws against the resettlement of all these refugees. The Arab world, by design, did not give any visas to these Palestinians to move freely in the Arab world. They call them brothers, Arab brothers, but try to give them a visa to live in another Arab country.
So even the Palestinians living in Gaza, which is, after all, a very small area, when it was connected to Egypt, they were not allowed to move to Cairo or Alexandria or other places in Egypt to get a job.
As a matter of fact, they were very restricted. There is a checkpoint. A lot of people think checkpoints exist only between Gaza and Israel, or between the West Bank and Israel. They don't know that there are lots of checkpoints on the other side, also preventing the Palestinians from coming into the Arab world. And also, as a matter of fact, right after Israel evacuated Gaza, there was an influx of people from Gaza who actually went through one of these Egyptian checkpoints.
I remember that. Yes. They had a sort of a celebration over in the Sinai Desert on the other side in Egypt.
Yes.
And were promptly pushed back.
They were actually
back.
Shot at in Egypt. But see, harm towards the Palestinians by Arabs is always a hush-hush situation. But if Israel humiliates somebody by searching them, it's always a big news.
Ms. Darwish, we're coming up on a break. That's one of the dangers of radio. We have to come up on a break. But there's so many things I want to discuss with you. When we come back, I want to talk about growing up in Gaza, both under Egyptian administration and then under Israeli administration. And I promise, folks, we will get to the current situation. But, you know, I like to go through the history because I think it's important for people to understand. Folks, if you want to call in and ask questions of Ms. Darwish joining the discussion, you're welcome to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. If that number causes you problems, if you don't get through, try another number, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from the inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder and say, "Everything's going to be okay." That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
Did you receive an email from the IRS saying you're due a tax refund? If so, don't open it. The IRS does not request personal information by email. Hi, I'm Russell George, Treasury Inspector General for Tax. The IRS and I want to warn you about bogus IRS emails and websites that look real, but are not. These emails are schemes played by crooks who are out to steal your money and identity. Fall victim to it, and you can spend months, even years, cleaning up the mess they've made of your good name and credit record. Help stop these crooks from ripping people off. If you get a suspicious email, forward it to phishing@irs.gov. That's phishing at irs.gov. Or call us at 1-800-366-4484. Again, that's 1-800-366-4484. Thank you.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest today is Nani Darwish. We're talking about the situation in Israel and its attacks on Gaza in response to the kidnapping of its soldier. But what we're really talking about is something much deeper. If you look at the current crisis in the Middle East, it's virtually impossible to understand it without going into some of the history. And who better to do that than Nani Darwish, who grew up in Gaza, both under Egyptian administration and Israeli administration. Ms. Darwish, welcome back to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. My pleasure.
Let me ask you this. How did it differ living under Egyptian occupation and then Israeli occupation in Gaza? Was it about the same, or were there strong differences?
I didn't live there under Israeli occupation.
I misunderstood.
We moved back to Cairo. I lived there only when it was under Egyptian occupation. But there is something that people forget. The infrastructure and economy of the West Bank and Gaza were completely neglected by Egypt and Jordan and by the Arab world and the Arab League. The Arab countries have used these two regions, as really as shooting grounds into Israel. Palestinians and Arabs who lived in that area allowed the Arab world to use their land as shooting grounds into Israel.
So you said there was no infrastructure. There were no universities or water treatment plants or electricity, things like that?
Very, very, very little. And it was all what has already existed before. But these two areas suffered economically under Arab control for many, many years until the Israelis came in.
The Israelis,
as a matter of fact, tried to promote the area into an economic, better economy for them, but it was rejected. And what happened is the lines for work from these two areas did not, Palestinians who wanted work did not line up to work on the Egyptian border. They didn't line up to work on the Syrian border or the Jordanian border or the Saudi border. Where did they line up to work? A lot of us forget that. They line up to work
on
the Israeli border, the very country they are being asked to terrorize by the Arab world.
That is an interesting point, particularly in the West Bank, where there, I mean, you could say, well, in Gaza there's desert on the other side, but certainly in the West Bank there's an entire country of Jordan where they could go and line up and work in Amman, but you're right, they don't do that.
Yeah, but as a matter of fact, the Sinai area is demilitarized since 67, and there's a boom there, construction of resorts.
That's true.
And
El Arish, there are neighborhoods there.
They could have used the population from Gaza, but they don't. It's by design.
Egypt, even today under Mubarak, purposely will not allow Palestinians to work there, even in Egyptian border towns in the Sinai?
No, they are not... They are treated as foreigners, and not a lot of people understand that. And it is a lot of people say also, oh, Gaza and West Bank are very poor, but you can't compare them with Israel a democracy. You have to compare them with the rest of the Arab countries around them. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the economy in the West Bank and Gaza and the standard of living, yeah, it is poor, but compare it to Egypt, compare it to Syria, compare it to Jordan, don't compare it to Israel.
So it's interesting because, of course, Gaza was run by Egypt and the West Bank was run by Jordan, and you're saying the economies there are better than in Egypt or in Jordan.
It's similar. It's similar. The standard of living of people there is similar. As a matter of fact, Egyptian villages have a much higher poverty rate than Gaza.
Let me ask you this. We said when Israel came in, they tried to help the economies of Gaza and the West Bank, and to some extent they were rebuffed. Can you go into a little more detail, explain how that happened?
I think that, first of all, they offered them work, but unfortunately, the people who went there to work, terrorists infiltrated them, and they went in to terrorize. So that made it worse for the people who really wanted to work in Israel. And then I did hear of some projects to mobilize the economy that Israel was trying to promote in Gaza and the West Bank. And, of course, Hamas and other terrorist organizations, any offer, any suggestion by Israel is completely turned down. So,
well, let me ask you this. When you grew up in Gaza, you went, I assume, to schools there in Gaza.
Correct.
And they were run by Egypt at that time?
I think...
Or by Palestinians, I don't know.
Both. I think the infrastructure was a combination of Egypt and the people, the local people. But it was a horrible experience for me from the standpoint of the hatred I was taught.
What did they teach you?
Oh, they taught us, don't take any candy from strangers. It could be a Jew trying to poison you. They portrayed Jews as monkeys, apes. And as children, because we've never seen a Jew, believe it or not, they are so close physically, but we've never seen them. So we really believed they were monsters who wanted to come.
They were monkeys.
Yes, and then not only that, they would tell us that if a Jew sees an Arab woman who's pregnant, they would want to kill her and make a bet among themselves to see if it's a boy or a girl. That's how they portrayed Jews. And this is...
And do people believe these things, or do they realize that these are just tales you tell to children?
Totally believed it. And you know how the whole situation now arrived? How did they arrive to all this hatred? When you want to make somebody do terrorism and jihad, you start first by scaring the hell out of the children from these people. And that's what they succeeded to do. They scared the hell out of us from Jews. And then it was easy for us to hate them. So hatred became very easy. And when you hate somebody, terrorism becomes acceptable. And this is a dynamic that a lot of people don't understand. They ask, oh, why do they hate us? Well, it's been done since birth. It's not even in school. It's everywhere. It's in mosques. In every mosque sermon, every prayer ends with praying to kill the Jews. May God destroy them. This is our prayer.
Really?
Yes.
They end with the prayer, may God destroy the Jews?
Every prayer in mosques, may God destroy the enemies of Islam, the Jews, and the infidels.
Now, they'll say this in Gaza, in the West Bank. What about, I certainly hope they don't say it in the United States or in Europe or in mosques outside the Middle East.
I heard that it happened in Europe and in the United States mosques as well. I didn't personally hear them, but there are some footage of recorded footage of terribly anti-Semitic sermons in Europe mosques and in the United States mosques. I think after 9/11, it's been tamed a little bit in the United States. But in London, until today, there is a sheikh who's in prison now in London, and he's originally Egyptian, by the way. Sheikh Hamza al-Masri, his name. The word Masri, it means Egyptian. His name is Hamza al-Masri, and he was advocating from the heart of England, from London, that an infidel who is a non-Muslim, if he walks in any Muslim country, his life is at the mercy of the people. He should be killed. Infidels desecrate, he was saying that they desecrate the ground of Muslim land. And they should be either be killed or they should be sold into slavery as dhimmis. But because dhimmitude and slavery now is not done openly as it used to, but so kill him. And you wonder why they're beheading Westerners?
It's amazing. Dhimmis, by the way, for those listeners who don't know, this is an Islamic legal term that refers to second-class citizens of, frankly, Jews and Christians. The idea was that they actually shouldn't be murdered. My understanding of classic Islamic law, they shouldn't be murdered, but should always be treated in a subjugated or humiliated fashion, that is, Jews and Christians.
But
did I get that right?
Yeah, this is correct. But Sheikh Hamza al-Masri was advocating killing them in London mosques.
We have to take another break. When we come back, I want to explore the role of Saudi Arabia in funding these kinds of mosques and schools that teach hatred, and then come to the heart of the interview in the next segment, which is how Ms. Darwish managed to escape a culture of hate to really come and to be the enlightened person she is today. Toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, or 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
This is Guy James, host of The Guy James Show. If you like factual, hard-hitting, liberal radio, yes, I said liberal, then I believe you'll like our show. We're a proud member of the Head On Radio Network, heard Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time at theguyjamesshow.com. You heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth.
Listen, man. Adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
No. You just got to find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4 and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers so that becomes an 8 too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest today, Nani Darwish, is fascinating. We will get to current Israeli policy and what's going on in Gaza, but I think it's very important to get the history of the region, to understand what's really going on, to give you the Inside Scoop. And Nani Darwish has lived there and has a fascinating perspective on it, one you don't hear very often. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, Ms. Darwish.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me ask you this. You were saying before the break, you were talking about really the hatred that's taught in schools, it's taught in mosques. Now, you know, I'm certainly not the expert you are, but I certainly studied classical Islam, and, you know, there are definitely places where Islam teaches violence, like Christianity did, or you know, at certain times. But at other times, they taught peace. They taught, you know, don't so much kill your enemies as convert them. Is this a new pattern? Is this have anything to do with the Saudi Arabian funding of Wahhabism, this more radical sect?
Correct. I think classical Islam that existed, for example, in Egypt, was a lot more tolerant And many minorities lived in Egypt safely.
Coptic Christians certainly have for many years.
The Copts of Egypt were originally, all of Egypt was Coptic before the Muslims came in the 7th century. But what happened is they were very tolerant, but still they were weak because there were still many Christians, many Armenians, many Greeks. So they felt like they had to please them. The radicals did not have the power to overwhelm all these big civilizations of the old world, which is Egypt, Mesopotamia, Turkey. They were much bigger and more powerful than the Arabian Peninsula, which brought them Islam. But
so how has it changed in the last 50, 100 years?
The Arabian Peninsula now has become the rich one, the powerful one. So
because of oil, I suppose.
Yeah, so what happens is Egypt used to be much more powerful. Now Egypt is the weaker one, the poorer country. And the wealth went through oil, not through hard work by Saudi Arabia, through oil. And money came easy. And a lot of Muslims in the area really truly believe that God gave the Saudis this wealth because it is time to re-establish the true Islam and radical Islam around the world. And
to what extent does Saudi Arabia fund these schools and mosques that teach some of this bitter hatred?
Yes, they go into all these countries, moderate Muslim countries, freely build mosques. Mind you, Saudi Arabia doesn't allow anybody to build any other church or a synagogue there. But they feel that they have the right to build around the world there and preach their religion. So, and they succeeded. They radicalized Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood now is very powerful in Egypt. And they radicalized all of the Middle East. And Europe now has a large Muslim population. And as a matter of fact, the Muslim population in Great Britain is even more radical than people in Cairo. And a lot of people don't even know that.
What's fascinating to me is how rare people, Americans, even talk about Saudi Arabia. Here it is, 15 of the 19 hijackers that murdered 3,000 Americans on September 11th came from Saudi Arabia. A lot of the hatred that you speak of that's taught in schools, in mosques, comes not from Egypt, but from Saudi Arabia, from this very wealthy, oil-rich kingdom. And yet, we talk about, not that they're good, but we talk about Saddam Hussein and Iran and Afghanistan, and it just seems that whenever you hear about Saudi Arabia, it's sometimes they even call it a moderate kingdom. Why do you think that is?
It's not a moderate kingdom. It's moderate because only for one reason. The kings they are a little bit more moderate than Osama bin Laden. So what can be worse now is that if Osama bin Laden or somebody like him would take power in Saudi Arabia, then that would be extremely dangerous.
That would be worse. So in other words, they're moderate compared to a real demon, but they're not exactly very moderate.
Exactly. And they are allowing, as a matter of fact, to the radical forces among them do whatever they want to do as long as you don't hurt us.
Let me ask you this. Do you think they've calmed down a bit after September 11th? I know some of the administration have suggested that they've gotten better. I wonder if they just haven't hidden some of what they're doing a little bit better. Do you think Saudi Arabia has moderated itself, or do you think it's basically the same?
A little bit, tiny, very small, but mostly it's through PR in the West. But inside the kingdom itself, it hasn't changed much. What they're doing is they are hiring a very effective PR organization, Western organizations in Europe, in America, and there is a lot of people who are on their payroll in the United States. They are sending to us students, radical students, they are paying their tuition to invade our campuses and start a Muslim student group in every college campus in the United States. They're very well
organized. So this is actually paid by, these aren't just kids from Arab countries coming to American campus. They're actually sent by the Saudi government.
They can't afford it on their own. All these hundreds of thousands of Muslim students on our college campuses sent from the Middle East are all wealthy children. Do you know how much it costs for sending a student kid. I'm from an upper class family in Egypt. I can't afford. My mom can't afford. Couldn't afford sending me on her own.
College is incredibly expensive these days. Yeah. What is it that Saudi Arabia gets in return for the paying these students' education?
They first of all they choose the right students from the beginning. I have a website called Arabs for Israel, and I just got an email, and that's not the first time. I get emails from students in the Middle East who are pro-peace with Israel, who tell me they do not pick us to go to America to give us the scholarships. The Arab governments pick the most radical students on campuses to send them to the United States.
So the moderates, which do exist in these Arab countries, are not sent to the United States. We only get the radicals.
Exactly. And I will send you that email because I'm about to post it. I just got it. I'm about to.
And I'll be happy to post it on my website after you do. Let me ask you something else. I know certainly we talked about hatred of Jews and Christians and the fact that Saudi Arabia won't allow churches and synagogues to be built there. We haven't talked much about the role of women. And as an Arab woman, how are women treated in the Middle East?
Well, unfortunately, women, there is a law, there is Sharia law. Sharia law is split between criminal law and family law.
Sharia law would be Islamic religious law.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Family law is really very harsh on women and their freedom and their respect in the house. When you give a man in a marriage contract the right to have three more wives, by itself, it puts a woman in a demeaning situation. After age 7, children belong to the father. A woman... her virginity has to be checked before the marriage.
Her virginity has to be
yes,
checked.
And if she's not a virgin, you give her back to the father and brother to kill her.
To kill her?
To kill her.
To actually kill her.
Yeah,
that's
the
crime.
Doesn't do that. It's none of my business. That's the woman here. It's like
Did you see these kinds of killings? Were they common?
I witnessed, actually, I know an Egyptian girl who was killed by her brother and father, and she was actually a maid in our house who came to us, and she was pregnant. She was the only 16 from the house that before coming to our house. She cried to my mom that the father was raping her, and when the wife...
Her own father?
No, not her own father. She was a maid in a previous house where...
In the house where she worked.
Her, and when his wife found caught it, she kicked her out in the middle of the night and told her, you're seducing my husband. And she, that girl, my mom sent her to the government. She didn't want to send her back to the family because she knew she was going to get hurt. And a year later, lo and behold, the agent who got her to us told us she was killed by her family for her disgrace, for being raped.
So let me ask you this. I want to phrase this delicately because I don't want to offend anyone, but... How does a self-respecting Muslim woman who respects herself and at the same time respects her culture and her heritage, how does she accept this culture? It must be very difficult.
I'll tell you how they do it. They become more radical than men. That's how they get respect in that country, in this culture. For a Muslim woman to earn respect in a radical Muslim country, she has to become as radical, if not more, than her husband. And that's what they do. They wear all the Islamic clothes. And I don't know if you've read the latest story of the wives of the terrorists that were caught in Canada. They were in the marriage contract. With their husband, they wanted to have a portion of the contract stating that I will have the right to divorce you if you do not do jihad, and that's how these women.
So in other words, if you don't kill yourself, I'll divorce you.
If you
kind of a
don't
strange
do jihad does not necessarily kill yourself because you can go through jihad without getting killed. But
all right, but if you don't go out and kill others, I will divorce you.
Or do the duty of of hating and eliminating the non-Muslim population of the world. So these women are Canadian Muslims, but they came from the Middle East. And what I'm trying to tell you is even a lot of people wonder, why do Muslim women defend radical Sharia law that hurt their family structure?
Right, exactly.
When you have a family contract that has a marriage contract that has three other spaces open for three more women.
Three more wives, because they can have up to four wives.
That is not a contract that gives respect to a woman. But you know who defends it the most? Women, Muslim women, defend it the most. And they defend it for one reason. They believe that by doing that, they are good Muslim women. And that's the tragedy.
Ms. Darwish, this is such a fascinating interview. I'm afraid, I'm sorry I have to take one more break. But when we come back, I want to get to the ultimate question, which is how you, as an intelligent woman, managed to escape this culture and come around and do the things that you do today. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK or 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
I told Walmart to sell the Easter egg dye kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg. We decided at Camp David that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. So now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We actually cut that last commercial shorter because I want as much time as I can get with my guest, Nani Darwish. Fascinating story. Okay, Ms. Darwish, you've been through all the horror of the Arab culture from which you came. How did you manage to come to a very different conclusion from most of these Muslim women that you talk about?
Not easy. It was very gradual. I used to be just as blind, and I defended the indefensible. I defended radical Islam. I defended the Palestinians blindly, even though they were doing terrorism for years. But when 9/11 happened, and I'm a U.S. citizen, and I recited the Pledge of Allegiance, and when I saw this airplane hit the Twin Tower, the second one, I knew right away. Jihad has come to America. And that's when I totally had to be honest with myself and really see what has a great civilization and a great religion has turned out to be. Has been reduced to a hateful religion and a hateful culture. And I do that out of love for America, out of respect for the 3,000 Americans that have lost their life in an instant by none other than my people, and led by an Egyptian from Cairo, the same city I grew up and was born in. And it was my duty to speak out. And I know that I was criticized by Arabs and Muslims who hate that I speak against terrorism. But I cannot call myself an American and just ignore it or look the other way. And so I started changing and speaking out, but my change also happened very gradual. When my father was killed and was called a shaheed and hailed as a martyr by Gamal Abdel Nasser himself, I hated martyrdom. I hated jihad, but I was too scared to say it because I felt it took away my father. And then gradually, when I moved to the United States, I saw other religions not insulting each other here. People respect.
Well, we insult each other. We just don't kill each other.
Yeah, exactly. But right now, at least, and there is hostility, of course, underlying. But they don't advocate killing each other in the churches and the synagogues in the United States.
And actually, we frankly get along pretty well, considering.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. So I was really impressed. I said, oh, my God, we have a long way to go, my culture. And then one incident, major incident, really changed me. 10 years ago, my brother was in Gaza, and he was 43 at that time. And he collapsed, had a stroke. And every Arab around him said, if you want him to kill, don't take him to Cairo Hospital. Take him immediately to Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. They chose to go to enemy hospital rather than their own hospital.
Because they knew they would get better treatment there.
Exactly. And you know, when this incident happened, I realized that Arabs, deep down inside, are trust Jews. But they are extremely envious of them, extremely jealous of their success. And I was very grateful to the government of Israel, to the doctors and nurses of Hadassah, who did the right thing, and they do treat Arabs. And my brother's life was saved by Hadassah Hospital.
Let me draw us to today. We only have about 5 minutes left. The Hamas, of course, has been elected by the Palestinians. It does not recognize Israel. It's been bombarding Israeli towns and kidnapped a soldier, and Israel's responding in force, attacking in Gaza, taking out electricity and bombing. Luckily, they do it in the early morning when so far, I don't think anyone's been killed, but this has a possibility of escalating. Mm-hmm. What can you say about this, and what do you think could possibly be done to help de-escalate the danger that I fear is growing day by day?
Unfortunately, you're speaking about 58 years of indoctrination and hatred. And a lot of people say, oh, they had no choice. They had to elect Hamas. No. You know why they elected Hamas? Because 99% of the people there sympathize with them. And that's the problem. A lot of people, we have to admit to ourselves that the Arab world has created a very an impossible situation in the West Bank and Gaza. And it is the duty of the Arab world to change their policy towards the West Bank and Gaza. If you notice that right before the escalation of things with Israel in Gaza, there was a civil war in Gaza between
the Palestinian Authority and Hamas.
And guess what? In order to end this little mini civil war, what did they do? They knew that they have become a country who doesn't understand what peace means. The people there don't even remember how to live in peace. So in order for them to end the civil war, instead of compromising with each other and talking to each other, they start throwing Scud missiles on Israel, and those missiles will cause enough distraction within Gaza, but when Israel shoots back. So,
that's a fascinating point. I believe it's an Arab saying that says that I hate my brother, but I join with him against my cousin. I hate my cousin, but I join with him against another family, and I join with the Arab people against another people. That in essence, the only thing that can bond the those that support Hamas and those that are against Hamas together would be hatred of Israel.
You cannot believe the function of Israel in the Middle East is. It's not only saving the peace inside the West Bank and Gaza. It's saving the peace in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in many countries, even non-Arab Iran, which is just a Muslim country. They're having internal turmoil. And what do? They start saying, we are going to destroy Israel. And that brings unity in the...
So that way people don't focus on their leader's mistreatment of them.
Exactly.
They focus on the external enemy.
Exactly. The same dynamic happened in Gaza right now. What did they do? They were suffering. They were killing each other. They were killing each other's important people as well. And the automatic normal behavior in the Arab world is, oh, we have internal problem. Let's go shoot on Israel. That's how they solve their problem. And then Israel shoots back. If this dynamic is not understood by the world, I'm sorry. I mean, then are we digging ourselves in the sand in the West?
And I don't think it is understood by the world. I don't think most of the world understands this.
It's very sad because we have intelligent media in the West. And if these media people in CNN, in all these, they have offices in the Arab world. They know the dynamic. But they choose really to ignore it and keep the Western people uninformed.
So is there a way out? I mean, how do you get out of a cycle of violence? Israel left Gaza, actually dismantled all the settlements they had in Gaza and said, here, it's yours, don't attack us and we'll give you more in the West Bank, and there's an attack.
By
how do you get
way,
out of that
standing
cycle?
Standing up with Israel more. Unfortunately, our media, whenever there is a problem, they go to America and say, President Bush or President Clinton, what are you going to do in order for you to, are you going to impose restrictions on Israel to make more peace with Arabs? They never ask the same questions from Arab leaders.
Do you consider this just self-defense, then, what Israel's doing?
I want to hear Arab, Western media ask, Mr. Hussein, Mr. Mubarak, King so-and-so, are you pressuring the Palestinians to accept peace? Are you doing your part in pressuring the Palestinians and not financing terror of the Palestinians? I never see them ask these questions. Those Arab leaders come in Washington and meet our leaders here, Democrats and Republicans, and I never see the right questions asked of Arab leaders by Western media. How come Western media is so heroic when it comes to our leaders, our West, such a leader, but they are such cowards when they are dealing, and they're appeasers, when they are dealing with tyrants and dictators?
Ms. Darwish, we only have a few seconds left, and it's probably not the kind of question you can answer in a few seconds, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Mm-hmm. Given what's going on, and given that you had to leave the region, you had to leave Gaza, come to the United States to open your eyes, what